Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live, a weekly hour-long program devoted to the discussion of all things animals. My name is Dana Hill. My guest this week from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Michael Scher. We'll be talking about animal ER.
Anything from trauma to snake bite to heart failure, kidney failure, poisonings, and many, many other major insults to the body.
We'll be taking your phone calls, too. The number is 352-392-8989. The debut episode of Animal Airwaves Live is coming up next after this news from NPR. Animal Airwaves Live, a brand new call-in show here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT FM. My name is Dana Hill. I'm the host of the program. Every week we are going to discuss several of the issues that affect lovers of animals, of all kinds of animals, everything from pets, which is what we're talking about today, mostly, and maybe sometimes even larger animals, horses and so on. I'm glad to have a guest here in the studio today is Dr. Michael Scher. That's the way it's going to work every week. We're going to have a veterinarian in, and we are going to take your calls. It's going to be a big component of the show, taking your calls. And today we are discussing with Dr. Scher animal ER, that would be emergencies related to your pets, anything that may arise from snake bite to eating something that is bad for the pet, maybe even trauma. So I thought that I would tell everyone the phone number. Phone number for you to call in with your questions is going to be 352-392-8989. Again, 352 is the area code, 392-8989. So just give us a call, and it's a pretty easy procedure. You just you'll be put on hold, and then when we get around to it, we will take your call. I'll say, hello, you're on the air, and then you will proceed with your question for Dr. Scher. Dr. Michael Scher is from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, and he is an authority on animal emergencies. So welcome to the program, Dr. Scher. I'm glad to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dana, and hope we can provide some useful information for everybody.
I hope so, too. I guess I'll start out with what I feel is a fairly basic question. Anyone who has a pet will have occasionally experienced a situation in which his or her pet will seem lethargic, tired, maybe a little bit down. Now, it could be a sign of the pet just being a little bit, I don't know what we would say for people, under the weather. How can someone know if there is a more serious issue involved, that the pet might need some emergency care, or if the pet's just sick and will suddenly get better?
Well, I always say that animals will usually tell you what's wrong, and the pet owner just has to learn how to listen and read them. But anytime there's a break in the norm, for instance, say diminished appetite or diminished exercise or intolerance to exercise or something more obvious like vomiting and diarrhea or difficulty breathing with an exaggerated abdominal or belly component, these would be things that should come to their attention.
I suppose that these manifest themselves differently depending on what sort of animal we're talking about?
Absolutely. Dogs might be more overt with the way they present that they're not feeling well. Cats, just by the nature of the species, can be a lot more subtle.
Right. I have, like I said, I have a couple cats. One in particular, well, she has hairballs and throws up on quite a regular basis, so I don't assume that there's anything too wrong there. But I know certainly of people anecdotally who have had their cat sort of disappear for a little while, maybe be hiding someplace, quiet, not really participating in the normal sort of family activities that the cat might otherwise engage in. Is that a reason to be concerned, or could there be some more social issues?
Well, as far as cats are concerned, it is true that when they get sick, they will oftentimes go off to the side or go under a piece of furniture. But if that's accompanied by a loss of appetite and not coming into the kitchen at the usual meal times, then that should definitely be an early warning sign.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the cat eating or changing its diet, I suppose one of the more time-sensitive components would be whether or not they're drinking, because I understand that cats can go a little bit longer without eating, but certainly not so long without drinking.
There are two types of drinkers. There are those who like to drink throughout the day, just take a little bit at a time, and those that might hover over the water bowl and drink a fairly large amount. But when water becomes excessive, we'll find where the patient is going back to the water bowl quite frequently, or the owner notices that they have to fill the bowl up, or we'll find in the case of a cat that it's jumping up to the sink level, trying to lick the water that's coming out of the faucet. Mm-hmm. Those are pretty telltale.
Interesting. I have a cat who really likes to drink running water.
Running water,
and
yeah.
I've never quite understood why, but she'll drink from the bowl, but she often will try to, particularly if she catches me with the water running, she'll come up like she wants to drink from the faucet or the hose or whatever.
That's a behavior pattern for your particular pet where you have established that as their norm.
Mm-hmm.
But if she were to be all over the place, even in the middle of the night, trying to get water, meowing because the water bowl is empty, then I would say, I think she's drinking a little bit too much.
Yeah, I'm glad I don't have that problem with my cat waking me up in the middle of the night. Now, you were talking about how dogs will present a little bit differently. And for people who have dogs, any pet that you've had for a while, you'll recognize the normal behavior patterns, but let's talk a little bit more about what would be considered abnormal, particularly like physically, what might they notice?
Okay. If a dog walks with its usual prance and the tail out and wagging and they're bright and alert, that's a good sign. But when they start to become ill, you'll find that that tail will get tucked under them. They'll lose that bounce. They'll lose that energy around them, and they will lay around more. And sometimes not run to the back door when you open it up to let them out, or if you go to the door yourself. Or they might not respond to somebody outside in their usual watchdog manner. They will tell you that either they are on or they are off quite a lot of the time.
Right. So if you regularly take your dog for a walk in the park and when you hold up the leash it doesn't seem interested, that could be a sign.
Right.
And so if a person has this issue, I would assume that something like that maybe would be cause to take your dog to your regular veterinarian and just say, well, you know, this is what's happening here. It might not be an emergency per se.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. Something's just not right. I didn't want it to go out of control. Let's just look into it, and then the veterinarian will proceed with a history and physical examination.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand, of course, that with traumas or other sorts of critical situations, perhaps the pet has gotten into something dangerous in the home, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I've heard, particularly for trauma, with human beings, there's something called the golden hour, this time in which it's very important that the pet be taken, or a person, let's say, in this case, be taken into the ER for treatment. Does such a thing exist with an animal? I would assume that time is of the essence with a trauma.
Absolutely. You took the words right out of my mouth. Time is definitely of the essence because animals can die from the same type of insults as people. So in the case of a hit by car, we worry about chest trauma, fractures, damage to the abdominal organs. These are things that can have devastating effects on the patient, and we need to get them into the ER pretty quick.
The number here is 352-392-8989. We're talking with Dr. Michael Scheer today about animal ER, everything from physical trauma to poisoning, everything from snake bites to heat stroke. I think it's time we should take a call. Hello, you're on Animal Airwaves.
Yeah, hi. I have an 11-year-old German Shepherd pit bull mix, and about last summer I noticed she had a growth on her left foot by her in between her big toe and her her pointer finger, I guess. And it's just been getting gradually bigger, and I'm worried that it might be cancerous or I don't know.
Dr. Scheer, how can someone tell if something obviously that's physically manifesting itself on the pet is something that's cause for urgent concern or just regular consultation from the vet?
Okay, my advice in this situation is if your German Shepherd mix is feeling good otherwise, it's definitely not an emergency. So my best advice would be to call, make an appointment where your veterinarian can get more facts about this as far as the history is concerned and do a physical examination. And then at that point, discuss with you various options for diagnostic tests that will definitely add more definitive information so that they could tell you more knowledgeably as far as what to do with it.
Thank you so much for your call. I see that it's getting to be the time of the year where it's getting a little bit warmer outside, and heat stroke is something that can certainly affect anyone left in an automobile. I know people like to go out for a drive with their dogs in their car. The tendency might be if you go to a place where an animal wouldn't be allowed inside, which is most public places, yeah, that you might leave your dog in the car. Suppose this is a very bad idea.
It is a definite bad idea. This is something that everybody must take heed of. Do not ever lock your pet in a car, even for 10 to 15 minutes, because I have watched the inside temperature in my own car go up to 125 degrees Fahrenheit in 20 minutes while the car was in the parking driveway of my house in the middle of the summer. So that could cause a severe insult to the patient and throw them into a heat stroke.
What would the appropriate response be to someone who sees an animal locked in an automobile?
Well, I don't want to be one to be quoted where you should go breaking car windows, but if this were something I did notice, I would try to rescue the pet. If I couldn't identify the owner right away, then I would definitely break the window and take the pet out of the car if I could, and then try to find the owner. But time definitely is of the essence.
When an animal is in this situation, not to get too technical, but what exactly is happening? Obviously, it's becoming very hot in the car. This must do something bad to the animal inside.
They are basically frying. They are cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And every organ system in the body will be adversely affected. And it does not take long. I would say after 20 minutes, things get very, very dangerous for that pet. And they're going to need emergency care as soon as possible.
We have another call. The number is 352-392-8989. Let's take that call right now. Hello, you're on Animal Airwaves Live.
Hi, I've got a question about my cat.
Great. Hello. Go ahead.
I wouldn't say it's an emergency. It's a chronic thing that's been going on for a while. He's a 6-year-old, somewhat overweight tabby. But the vet doesn't really have an answer. He starts to cough and snort and sneeze, and then great globs of brown mucus come out of his nose. And the vet has tested, and there doesn't seem to be a bacterial infection, but it's chronic and it's really messy.
So this happens, how often would you say? A couple, once a week maybe?
Several times a week.
Several times a week. It's not a hairball?
No.
Interesting.
I mean, he has he has coughed up hairballs before because I have another long-haired cat that he grooms.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's more in his sinuses. It seems to be more nasal.
Dr. Scheer, I assume that your pet, he eats and drinks normally?
Yes, he does.
Okay.
Sometimes I think he might drink a little too much, but I was listening to what you were saying about drinking, and I think it's probably normal.
What do you make of this, Dr. Scheer?
Okay, well, you are a very good fact gatherer, and I would say that we definitely have a problem here involving the sinuses and the nasal cavities. Mm-hmm. It might very well be due to an infection, but there are other insults that can cause these types of clinical signs as well. But the most common being like an earlier viral illness when they were younger, and then that's complicated by a secondary bacterial infection that could become chronic. But I can't diagnose it here, but I would say that what we would do at the University of Florida, we will admit such patients for a further diagnostic evaluation that requires various forms of imaging, such as a CT scan, and then we'll also pass a little scope, and we'll look up the nasal cavity and try to gather as much information, maybe get a little biopsy, and proceed from there with assessing all that data when it comes back from our laboratory in order to give you the best explanation and then the best medical advice.
Yeah, okay. How, I mean, it's been going on for a long time, and do you give him, hang on a second, I'm just going to look at it here, an amino acid, lysine,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to kind of ease it back a bit,
mm-hmm.
but I guess my biggest concern is when do I know when it really is, a big emergency when it's been going on for this long?
Right. It's definitely not an emergency, and I think a thorough medical workup mm-hmm. would establish the information that you need to know. And some of these problems could be chronic and some might not even be curable. They might be manageable. Mm-hmm. But again, it wouldn't be right of me to speculate any further than that.
Yeah, I understand. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much for your call.
Have a nice day.
I have a somewhat silly question for you, Dr. Scheer.
No question is silly.
Okay. Do pets experience allergies?
Yes, they do. We do see that on a routine basis, and they could be allergic to plants, foods, all types of organic material, whether it's airborne.
So a person who had a runny nose, you might suspect perhaps they were allergic to something in the air, pollen, or I'm allergic to, ironically, my cat.
Mm-hmm. That's not good.
Would a pet have any kind of symptoms like a person would if the pet were allergic to something?
Very similar. Pets do talk to you much in the same language as we talk to ourselves or other humans talk to us. And if they have irritation in their nasal cavity, they'll sneeze. If they have an irritation to their upper airway they have early lung disease, they might cough, and sometimes combinations of both. So they will express themselves. All we have to do is listen to them.
Mm-hmm. Now, human beings can take a variety of medications for allergies or other symptoms. What about animals? Is there an equivalent medicine for something like an allergy?
Yes, there are equivalent medications for allergies, much similar to what humans get, but we're very careful to make sure that we have our clinical impression down pat before we start prescribing.
I would assume that a person should never give their pet a human medication.
I would not advise that because some drugs can cause problems, and if they're used inappropriately, then they become emergencies.
I see. So a person who maybe has given a pet a human medication might find themselves in the unfortunate position of then inducing an emergency situation.
That is possible. But it depends on what drug they use.
Mm-hmm.
Some drugs are pretty innocuous, or should I say, pretty fairly tolerable,
mm-hmm.
Where you're not going to get into trouble. Other drugs can pack a stronger punch and become a problem for the animal.
Let me ask you then, I'd like to talk a bit about dangers around the house, maybe some chemicals of everyone probably underneath their sink in their bathroom or in their kitchen has some dangerous stuff, and maybe some pets can be a little bit nosy sometimes. What are the real troublesome things that a pet might get into, and what would be an appropriate response?
All right. As far as chemicals around the house, I would say you have to make sure that things like antifreeze, which is ethylene glycol, is definitely out of the reach of the animal. You want to make sure that all human medications are out of the reach of the animal, because they go into drug overdoses and they could have severe life-threatening problems. Other things that could cause problems would be chemicals such as lye, which might be a toilet bowl cleaner. Mm-hmm. And sometimes dogs will lap anything, and then it's too late. So it's best to make sure that these things are kept off and put in a closet with a door where the animal can't get into them.
Certainly for a lot of animals, cats in particular, I know this, they're pretty finicky about what they eat, and something like bleach or ammonia is not going to appeal to a cat. But what is it about antifreeze that makes it attractive to an animal?
Antifreeze is sweet, and you'll find that some animals don't like it, and they'll just have an aversion for it. But then there are some dogs and some cats that will drink it, and it doesn't take much. I would say the equivalent of one lap per kilogram body weight can cause a pretty severe syndrome that we call antifreeze intoxication, which is a very complicated problem.
And do you have a procedure that you undergo when a pet is brought in and presents that problem?
Absolutely. Once we have that history of ingestion or a strong association with it, there are anecdotes that we could administer them, and that's where time is definitely of the essence, where we have a 4-hour window, okay, optimally to treat antifreeze intoxication.
A pet that has consumed some sort of dangerous chemical in the house, is the risk that the chemical gets into their digestive system? Does it go into their blood? I don't know a lot about anatomy and how this works, but what's the real danger there?
Okay, if it's something like antifreeze, the patient will lick it, and then it will pass from the digestive tract to the liver, where it will be metabolized to certain other substances which have the toxic effect on the body.
I see.
And it's right during that period of time that occurs within the first few hours that we want to intercept that with the treatment.
A little bit later, I want to ask about some of the household plants that may have such an effect. Right now, though, I think we can go back to the phones. Let's take another call. Hello, you're on Animal Airwaves Live.
Okay. On the subject of antifreeze, is there not a non-toxic antifreeze that's sold? And isn't that a better choice to use for our vehicles in case they have a leak
that's a great question.
Don't know about?
A great question.
Okay. The answer to that is yes, there is a different type of antifreeze other than the ethylene glycol. But if a dog ingests that, they could get sick as well, but they won't present with the life-threatening complications that we associate with the specific ethylene glycol type of antifreeze. But it's just best to keep the animals away from the car when you're changing that antifreeze, because it doesn't take much for you to be distracted and them to come up and start licking it.
Though this can be a particular problem with of a car that may have an antifreeze leak. You see this from time
to
time. You'll walk by, and where a car has been, you'll see a little puddle of a greenish kind of liquid.
Right. That's all it takes. And if that happens, it's going to be most unfortunate, because nobody's going to witness the ingestion.
Right.
And then we have to play a detective in order to try to reason it out.
I wonder, will the more safe antifreeze, will it be indicated that is less harmful to animals?
When you compare both products, I would say yes, but anytime you take in a foreign substance and drink or ingest enough of it, you can get sick from it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you so much for that question. I appreciate it. Plants that may be potentially dangerous to an animal. I've heard all sorts of rumors about different ones, and some of these may be old wives' tales. Poinsettias. Someone told me once oleander is dangerous, but there are other ones as well that are dangerous probably to one animal and not another.
Okay. There are some plants that, thank goodness, are irritating to the oral cavity. So you take a plant such as the poinsettia, it will cause a burning or stinging sensation, and the animal that eats it will salivate a lot, but that usually prevents them from actually eating it.
Mm-hmm.
So except for the irritation problem, it's not going to kill them in most circumstances. This is the season of the Easter lily,
mm-hmm.
and anybody with pet cats should keep them away from the Easter lily because it can cause severe kidney failure.
Amazing. See, this is something I had no idea mm-hmm. about, because my whole life growing up around Easter, we had Easter lilies
in the beautiful.
Home. And yeah. I never saw a cat tamper with an Easter lily. But then again, some cats are nosier than others.
Cats love to nibble on indoor plants. Anybody who has cats with along with plants in the house, there is that tendency. But keep them away from the Easter lily, because if they go into kidney failure, it's difficult to cure them.
And what about for dogs? What are the more dangerous plants for dogs?
Dogs, the biggie around here is the sago palm, which is the cycad plant. And if you walk through the grounds at the University of Florida and
they're
around many homes, there are sago palms all over the place. And the bad news is that every part of that plant is toxic.
Wow, the leaves, the
leaves, the fruit, the bark. Just stay away from the sago palm. And I hate to say this with the horticulturists out there who are probably hating me because they like to grow them and sell the plants. But if dogs ingest it, they could get into severe liver failure.
Is this something that dogs would commonly do? I wouldn't think that there's much delicious on the sago palm.
Dogs can do anything. That's the safest assumption to go on. And yes, they will eat these plants, sometimes in a playful manner, and then accidentally ingest pieces of it, and they will get very sick.
Something that I think can pose a risk for animals would be interactions with other animals. And I understand that you deal sometimes with animals that have been bitten by snakes. Now, this can come up, I suppose, in a variety of different ways. One way that I would seem to think is an obvious way would be out in nature. People like to go for walks. People who may go to a place like the Hawthorne Trail, for example, which is a great place to run or jog or bicycle, you might encounter some sort of venomous snake, I mean, well, any kind of snake, but perhaps a venomous snake. I know that I've seen a venomous snake out there on a walk. Dogs, even on a leash, might want to explore their surroundings. So what are the potential risks? What are the dangerous snakes that we have to look out for? You know, what can happen here?
Okay. Well, let me say that the risks are great, because dogs are inquisitive and they will stick their nose right in front of a snake. And in this part of the country, we happen to have several types of poisonous snakes. We have those called the pit vipers that include the rattlesnake family and the water moccasins. And then we have the coral snakes. And these are potentially very life-threatening situations for any animal that becomes bitten by them.
Okay, I'd like to get back to this in just a minute, but
sure.
I think we have a couple callers on hold. Hello, you're on Animal Airwaves Live.
Hello?
Hello, you're on Animal Airwaves Live.
Yes, I have a question that's a little bit off topic. With the hot weather coming, I have severe issues where I live with mosquitoes and fleas and ticks. I heard on a segment of Animal Airwaves on the news part about something called catnip oil. And I was wondering, I've tried to find some way to to get some of this, and I'm unable to. I wondered if there were any leads you could give me on that.
I'll be very honest with you. I cannot give you those leads, but you might be able to go on to a reference source like Google and come up with information regarding that particular substance. Now, I assume that you're going to use this as a repellent, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The thing to be careful of when you're using oils is you want to make sure that they're safe for the animal and that safe doses are applied. I couldn't sit here and tell you to do it until I actually knew more about that particular product and the source of that product.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Yeah, I really,
you're welcome, sir.
I appreciate your call, and good luck. And we'll be back in just a moment with more with Dr. Scher. This is Animal Airwaves Live. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls. The number is 352-392-8989. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. We're talking today with Dr. Michael Scher from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. The topic today is animal ER emergencies related to pets and animals. And the number for your telephone calls is 352-392-8989. We've got some email messages to answer in just a bit, but I think right now we can go back to the phones if we're ready. Let's take a call. Hello, you're on Animal Airwaves Live.
Hi, I got a question for you. I have a house cat and a dog, and unfortunately, I can't keep the dog away from the cat's litter box, and he eats the scat and then throws up some nasty yellow vial. Is it A, harmful to the dog, and B, is there anything that I can feed the cat that would discourage the dog from doing that, or... Do you have any suggestions?
Okay, that is a very common problem. In fact, I even had that with my own dog at one time. And they're attracted to the proteins and the fats that are in the stool, and as disgusting as it might sound. But some dogs will not do that. Other dogs will go after stool all of the time. Now, what we could do for dogs who eat their own stool, one of the things we used to do is recommend adding a meat tenderizer, like Adolph's meat tenderizer, to their food. And the digestive product of that tenderizer would add a bad taste to the stool. Now, the problem is adding such a substance to the cat's food might cause that cat to reject it and not want to eat that food, and therefore we're left with this problem. So if you can set up an enclosed litter box that has an opening that's big enough for the cat but not big enough for the dog's head, that would be the way to help solve that problem.
I tried that,
yep.
And then the cat refused to use it.
Oh, I see. Well, yeah, cats are
panicking. That's a bigger problem.
Okay, well, then the only other thing that we could do is to try to keep that cat box as clean as possible. If it requires picking up the solids a few times a day, at least that'll take away the source.
But, Dr. Scher, is there any potential serious danger in the dog doing this?
For the most part, no. There will be no danger for all the instances that we've had this call to our attention in veterinary medicine. For the most part, they will handle it without any problems whatsoever. Occasionally, it might make them nauseous and they might vomit, but better out than in if it's going to make them sick, as I say. So I wouldn't be overly concerned about it.
Thank you so much for your call. The number here is 352-392-8989. This is Animal Airwaves Live. We're talking to Dr. Michael Scher about Animal ER. I think we're going to take another call now. Hello, you're on Animal Airwaves Live.
Yes, good afternoon. I was just listening to the radio show when I heard somebody ask about where to find catnip oil.
Yes.
And as this is something I'm kind of curious about, it's available, I think, locally from a company that they make it locally. They've done some research at UF on catnip, the effectiveness of napatalactine, which is an active ingredient in catnip oil. But I think it's locally available in a product called Beat It Bug Spray from a company called Jade and Pearl. They have a product called Beat It Bug Spray, and it's used for animals and humans.
Now, would such a product, it's used for pest control, like for mosquitoes, fleas, that sort of thing? Is that what we're talking about?
Correct. They've done some research at UF to try to get it approved for human use, and I'm not sure if they've actually got that labeled through the government yet, but I think that they have it approved for animal use. And you can find it at some of the local stores, Ward's, and some of the other health food stores. You can go online to, like, jadeandpearl.com, and they have the product there. It's called Beat It Bug Spray.
All right. Well, yeah. Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you very much. That was very informative.
So Dr. Scher, now with products like this, I suppose the goal is to have pest control that is less overtly toxic or harmful to the environment, like maybe some harsher chemicals can be. And understandably, people want to, you know, keep pests like insects, mosquitoes and fleas and whatnot away. But with something clearly formulated for an animal, like topical flea treatments and whatnot, those are obviously designed for animal use. But what about other kinds of pest control remedies? Certainly outdoor harsh chemicals that people might use on their lawn. Can that pose a dangerous problem for animals?
Yes. Those chemicals are just loaded with potential dangers. My advice is to use the products that are veterinary approved, and if they're topical products, they're usually deposited over the neck or over the shoulder area, which makes it impossible for them to lick and ingest. And if you're going on a generic product like the catnip oil, my advice would be do not put it where the cat can lick it, because then we might get sick from it.
Now, I would suppose that the assumption would be that it's got the word catnip in it, and since cats love catnip, I know I give it to my kitty all the time, and she goes bonkers. You might assume that it would be safe, but that might not be the case.
Safe as far as the odor is concerned, fine. It might cause some type of a euphoric sensation for them. At least it seems that way. But as far as eating it, it might cause a problem. I've never had any real emergencies that dealt with that, but it wouldn't be anything I would be nonchalant with.
I see. Yeah, that's good advice. I think we have some more calls. Let's go ahead and take another call. Hello, you're on Animal Airwaves Live.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
I have read in a number of veterinary publications that onions are bad for dogs. Why?
Very good. That is a great question. And onions have a particular chemical in them that can cause changes in the dog's red blood cells, which can then cause those red blood cells to burst. And we call this syndrome Heinz spotty hemolytic anemia. And it would be, therefore, very prudent not to let a dog get into raw onions. Maybe a little bit mixed in their food isn't going to cause a problem. We've all seen that go over okay. But if they're going to eat the whole onion bulb, they could get into trouble.
Something like this, I wonder, these are issues that seem so, I mean, an onion is such a common food.
Yes.
And everyone would have an onion probably in his or her kitchen. But you wouldn't think that something that a human can so safely eat, I mean, with something like a sago palm, obviously a person is not likely to eat a sago palm. But with an onion, something that is so ingestible for a person, aside from the tendency for it to make you tear up, it can cause a problem in an animal. And there are other foods as well that humans can safely eat but are not safe for animals. Can we talk a little bit about some of those?
Surely. First, let me say that sago palm is also toxic in people, in case somebody were to eat it. So you got to be careful with kids.
Yes, don't eat a sago palm.
Right. Now, as far as species sensitivities to certain food toxins, it all rests on the biochemistry or on the chemistry of that particular animal. For instance, if you were to give onion powder to a cat, that can cause the same blood problem as it does to the dog. And that's because the onion powder will contain certain chemicals that will affect the chemistry of the metabolism of those red blood cells. And certain species are more susceptible to those particular toxins because they can't handle those toxins and therefore become sensitive to small amounts. So you do have what we call species sensitivities or predilections for the toxic effect.
Now, a cat wouldn't be likely to want to eat chocolate, but a dog, which is likely to eat just about anything that it can reach, would love to eat chocolate. So what is the danger posed by something like chocolate?
Dogs love chocolate, and some chocolates contain a certain chemical in it called theobromine that acts as a central nervous system stimulant, which can make the animal very, very excited, and it can also cause a very rapid heart rate. And the type of chocolate that is particularly incriminated are those blocks of baking chocolate.
Right.
But if the dog gets into a bowl of candy and eats a whole bunch of it, they could get into trouble from that as well.
Yikes. We had an emailed question about xylitol. A person wrote to say that his or her dog consumed some sugar-free gum and had an adverse reaction. What happens there?
Okay, there's the xylitol causing an adverse reaction involving blood sugar control, and the patient's blood sugar level can drop all the way down. And when that happens, the brain becomes dysfunctional, and they're basically hypoglycemic.
And this is an issue that would require immediate veterinary attention?
Absolutely. This is a definite emergency. And if I were to have a call like that come in over the phone, I would ask the owner to give the patient perhaps some maple syrup or Karo syrup that will act as a glucose source for them if getting to the emergency facility is going to take time.
I see. I think we have time to take another call. Hello, you're on Animal Airwaves Live.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
My question has to do with an African gray parrot. Are you able to answer questions about a parrot?
I do not deal with birds at all, actually. So I might stumble here, and I would want to refer you to one of my colleagues who's more specialized in the avian species.
Okay, well, I have two questions.
Okay.
You may have some information about it.
I'll give it a shot.
The first is that I've understood that chocolate is not good for an African gray. But this particular African gray loves chocolate and tries to get it every time he can. And so that my first question is that harmful to the bird? The second question that I have has to do with socialization. And I was told that if the bird doesn't get a couple of hours a day of socialization, you know, with a human being, that it will stop eating or pull its feathers out or something like that. Is there any truth to that?
Okay.
Well, if I may, I would like to just say, even in this case, if Dr. Scher isn't well-versed in birds, we will, in upcoming episodes of Animal Airwaves, certainly deal with animal behavioral issues for all kinds of animals, and we'll have veterinarians on who would be able to happily discuss a species like African gray. But as for the other question about the chocolate, I would have a tendency to think that if the bird has consumed this and shown no sorts of signs of distress, maybe that would have a tendency to make someone think that there wasn't a danger. Is that true?
I think it's going to be a matter of quantity. Mm-hmm. And if it's just a morsel and the bird has showed previous tolerance to that, then I would say don't give any more than a morsel. But if it were to be a larger amount, or if the source of the chocolate were to change from an M&M, for instance, to Baker's cooking chocolate, that's where we could get into trouble. So I would take heed and not be careless with this because of what we know it can cause with other species. Now, as far as the socialization is concerned, let's just say that this will spread across all pets, the animal kingdom. If we want them to interact with humans, then there has to be the contact time and the necessary adjustment time so that they could study our ways, if I could use that anthropomorphically, and we're studying their ways as well. But when birds are bored, or if they have some type of psychological stress, if we could apply the term psychological stress to them, I would say they can be driven to have bad habits, and picking at their feathers is one of the ways they will show that.
This, I suppose, is, as you just said, something that can be reflected in any animal that we may have in our lives, any pet that we might have. There will be the issue of interaction with human beings. Some relationships might create stressful situations. If you introduce another pet into your home, that can create a different kind of mentality for the pet. So anything can happen. That's one of the reasons that even at my house we've kind of resisted the impulse to introduce another kitten, for example. Mm-hmm. We just have such a well-behaved kitty that I don't know how she would behave if we brought in another cat, so rather just not take the risk. But, well, here we are, gosh, already up against the clock. So just want to say thank you to Dr. Michael Scheer for coming in, being the guest here on the debut episode.
You.
Yeah, thank you for being the guest on the debut episode of Animal Airwaves Live. We're going to have a new episode each week, and I hope that you'll be able to tune in. And I really apologize to the callers who we missed today. It's we're just up against the clock, but I do hope that they will call in during another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. I want to say thank you to Richard Drake. Thank you to Sarah Carey. Thanks to Steve Seip, who is the technical director for the program today. My name is Dana Hill. Tune in again next week at 1 o'clock on Saturday for another edition of Animal Airwaves Live.